I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Reports today say that Sandy Berger, who yesterday resigned his position as advisor to John Kerry, didn't tell the Kerry campaign until this week that he has been under investigation at least since January. The former Clinton national security advisor resigned amid revelations that he removed classified documents from the National Security Archive. Republican leaders have accused Berger of breaching national security and suggest he may have passed those documents to the Kerry campaign. Berger's lawyer, Lanny Brewer, rejects that claim. He spoke this morning on the Today Show.
We began this matter talking responsibly to the Department of Justice now about a year ago. This matter is a year old. Never once in all of my discussions with the Department of Justice has there ever been any allegation or assertion like that.
Eric Lichtblau is a New York Times Washington, D.C. reporter. Eric, there's some discussion over how Berger actually removed those documents. Could you start with what was he doing in the archive? Why was he there? And what do we know about the removal of the documents?
Well, Berger was preparing last year for his testimony before the 9/11 Commission. The Clinton administration had essentially made him their point man in going through thousands and thousands of pages of documents. He spent about 3 days in the summer and fall of 2003 in a secure reading room. And in the course of that, it's his position and that of his lawyer that he inadvertently took some drafts and versions of an after-action report dealing with the Millennium bombings and accidentally put those in his leather portfolio, and that he also took some handwritten notes of the documents he was reviewing and put those in his pocket. You're not supposed to take even your own handwritten notes out of the reading room, so that itself is a technical violation.
And what are Republicans saying?
They're very skeptical, openly skeptical of his explanation. They've accused him all day yesterday of intentionally having taken this material and perhaps even passing it on to Kerry in his position as a senior advisor in order to give Kerry ammunition for attacks on the Bush administration. And that's a charge that Berger and his lawyer vehemently denied.
Does it make sense that a Clinton-era document about a foiled terrorist plot would contain any ammunition against President Bush?
Well, it cuts both ways. I mean, the Millennium plot was something the Clinton administration was actually proud to have foiled, but there was also information in those after-action reports that was warning of possible sleeper cells in the U.S. long before 9/11, and that al-Qaeda was still an active force and we had not made a dent in it. So it's a period that could both work against and for the Clinton administration, and same for the Bush administration.
And what are the Democrats saying to the claims of the Republicans?
They point out that this is an investigation that's months and months old. The National Archives first discovered the documents missing last October, and they believe it's suspicious that this is only now just coming out. The 9/11 Commission will release its report tomorrow, which is obviously expected to be very critical of the Bush administration and its handling of terrorism intelligence, and to a lesser extent, the Clinton administration.
Well, do you think this controversy will have an impact on the release of the report?
Well, I think it's certainly added a whole nother layer of interest. It's distracted people to some extent, refocusing attention on what the Clinton administration may or may not have done.
What about the impact on Berger? There was some sense that he might be a cabinet member in a Kerry administration.
Sure. I mean, he is had been one of Kerry's most trusted advisors on foreign policy. He had been talked about as a possible Secretary of State or other senior cabinet-level official. And there are Democrats who were already saying to me yesterday that they think this could seriously damage or even kill his chances of that.
New York Times reporter Eric Lichtblau speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Eric, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
It'll be a green Christmas this year for Microsoft shareholders. The company announced that it will hand out $32 billion to its investors in December. The company's largest shareholder, its chairman, Bill Gates, will receive $3.3 billion, which he says he'll put into his foundation. As for what the windfall means to individual investors who own Microsoft stock or mutual funds with investments in the company, well, joining us on the line is Megan McArdle, who writes for The Economist magazine. Megan, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, obviously this is good news for its investors, but why is Microsoft doing this?
There's basically three reasons. The first and most obvious is that Microsoft is a maturing company. You know, over the past decade, it's been up by 8 times. That's the mark of a fast-growing company that's turning in, you know, extreme growth in their customer base and their services. Now it's basically started, recently announced that it's starting to focus on costs. So when a company starts to focus on costs, what you know is this is a business that's starting to settle down into sort of cash flush middle age. The second reason is that it's a big legal and regulatory target, and having a lot of cash sitting on its balance sheet is just a temptation to various states or lawyers to sue, hoping to hit the lottery. And the third reason is that there's been a change in the tax law. The Bush tax cuts, among other things, have equalized the treatment between capital gains and dividends under the tax law, making it more attractive for companies to issue dividends.
So, in other words, when companies are making a lot of money, that's the way it's supposed to work. They are supposed to share the wealth.
Exactly. And over the past, you know, really in the 1990s, we saw companies either holding on to their cash or dispersing it through share buybacks, which have a, you know, number of somewhat less salutary. In other words, they're not as regular as dividend payments, so they don't offer quite as good a metric for investors to watch the performance of their company. So this is actually, you know, this is good news for investors all over. Economic theorists generally say that all else equal, you would prefer to see cash distributed as dividends. So it's a good move.
And has there been pressure from the investors? Have they been clamoring for a higher return on their investments?
Well, I'm not sure higher return is the right thing. They've been clamoring for, now that they can get dividends out at a lower tax rate, they've been clamoring for companies across the board to stop doing as much with their, you know, to stop socking away the cash that they get and instead start paying it out to investors more regularly.
Hmm. Now, clearly the huge stockholders are going to be doing very well with this move, but what about the individual investor who just has a small amount of stock or perhaps someone who owns a mutual fund that has Microsoft stock in it? Will they benefit as well?
Well, excluding institutions and officers and directors like Bill Gates, who clearly has the largest holding in Microsoft, individuals own about 30% of Microsoft shares. So you're going to see about $9 billion going to individual investors. So they're certainly going to see a big windfall. This is also going to be a big thing for almost anyone who owns a mutual fund to watch. Microsoft is one of the most widely held stocks and mutual funds because of its just consistent, excellent performance over the past 20 years. So people in mutual funds should see this coming in right around Christmas.
And we should probably take note of the fact that when Bill Gates announced that he's going to give all of his one-time dividends of $3.3 billion to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, that puts it at about $30 billion. It already had $27 billion in it. Is this a one-time windfall, or do you think that in a few more years Microsoft might be rewarding its shareholders again with another big bonus?
You know, Microsoft is just, you know, what business people call a cash cow. It throws off, you know, about $1.5 billion a month from its operating activities. So, yes, I expect that as their cash hoard starts to build up again, they're going to want to get it out the door to investors again in a couple of years.
Thank you so much, Megan.
My pleasure.
Megan McArdle writes for The Economist. She joined us from New York.
A new heart drug for black patients has shown such dramatic promise that clinical trials have been halted. The drug is called Bidil, and if it gets FDA approval as expected, it will reportedly be the first drug specifically for a single race. But even doctors involved in the study worry about tailoring drugs to one racial group, warning there are real benefits but also real risks. Joining us on the line from Chicago is Dr. Clyde Yancey, director of the Heart Failure and Transplant Program at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. He's also a member of the steering committee for the study. Welcome, Dr. Yancey.
Thank you, Robin. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Dr. Yancey, as we understand it, there are some scientists who say that race has little meaning in medicine, that it's genetic factors that cross races that really count. But others point out that racial groups tend to share genetic factors.
And obviously, everybody's right. Race is a very large bucket that contains lots of different issues, and both schools of thought are correct.
And what would be the slippery slope, as some say, in assuming that a whole race would respond one way to a drug?
Well, part of the dilemma there is that nobody would want a physician to make a decision about treatment just based on how you appear as you walk in the door. And in our fast-paced society where everything is time-sensitive, it is too easy for someone to look up and say, there is a patient of one persuasion or the other, aha, I should do this, and go move forward. It really is important for each person to be dealt with as an individual case, the characteristics of the disease identified, the risk factors investigated, and then a comprehensive treatment plan created.
Yeah. We understand that when it comes to heart disease, black patients tend to have more hypertension, while white patients tend to have more arterial blockage. It has something to do with nitric oxide in blacks, a deficiency of nitric oxide. And then also, it's been explained to us, other socioeconomic factors, maybe even a lack of access to medical care. But further, why would, in your best guess, a black heart patient react better to this medication?
That's a good question, and you've touched on a few issues. We do believe that hypertension is more common in African-American patients and that the consequences of hypertension are more dramatic. And the reason for that is probably multifactorial. We like to use that word to say that we don't know. That is to say that there are many different reasons. One of the plausible reasons is that there is a compound that's been identified in the last several years called nitric oxide. When it is in abundance in your circulatory system, your vessels are pliable, they're soft, they relax, and it helps to prevent you from having high blood pressure. When it's in deficiency in your circulatory system, then those things don't occur.
In the meantime, those who roll the dice with this medical company, we hear the stock has just shot through the roof. Do you expect a huge population of black heart patients to turn to this medication?
Well, I can't say anything about the business issues, but it should be stated that right now in American medicine, even worldwide medicine, we do in fact have very effective treatment strategies that work in all people, including African Americans, and they have to be applied first. And I would view Bidil, this new approach, as an adjunctive approach, because that's exactly how we studied it in the trial. We treated everyone appropriately first and then added this on top. So this is another step forward, and we should not jettison what has already been proven to be successful.
Right, including lifestyle changes and all of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Lifestyle changes are at the core of all of this.
Yeah. Dr. Yancey, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Clyde Yancey, Director of the Heart Failure and Transplant Program at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. For more on the drug Bidil, go to our website, here-now.org.
Just ahead, the legal world tries to make sense of a Supreme Court ruling that could change thousands of criminal sentences in federal court.
And later, one man's story of looking for work and coming up empty until he found a job in Iraq.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Prosecutors, defense attorneys, and state legislatures around the country are scrambling to interpret the Supreme Court's recent ruling that calls into question whether federal sentencing guidelines are constitutional. In the Blakely v. Washington case, the Supreme Court said judges could not act on their own to give a sentence above the guidelines. Only juries can do that. The ruling could affect thousands of criminal cases now underway. Joining us to explain further is Ohio State University Law Professor Douglas Berman. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Tell us why this is so chaotic.
I think it's a combination of factors. One is that the Supreme Court's decision in Blakely clearly states what can't be done, but doesn't clearly explain what can be done. And so that leads to some immediate confusion that we have rulings striking down the federal sentencing guidelines as unconstitutional because they do what can't be done, but they don't then know, judges in lower courts don't know what can be done in the alternative. And so that's part of the problem. In addition, it's just so chaotic because unlike in some other areas of the law where there may be time to sort of work out all the complications in a big decision. There are ongoing trials. There are ongoing sentencing hearings planned. There are cases sort of in the mill across the country in just about every federal and state jurisdiction that has to try to figure out what the Supreme Court was trying to say in Blakely. And so you combine those forces, a somewhat opaque opinion, with hundreds of courts and thousands of defendants sort of in process, and you get what I've described as a form of legal chaos.
Well, exactly. So what are they doing in the meantime?
They're all experimenting in a variety of kinds of ways. Judges in different courts, both state and federal, are sort of doing their best to figure out what follows from the Supreme Court's Blakely decision. And part of what gives it a chaotic sense is it's very easy for two very good judges to come out on different sides of the equation about what should be the consequence, especially in the federal system.
Now, these sentencing guidelines have been in place for 20 years.
That's
they
right.
have been described as the justice system's version of paint by numbers. How was it that judicial discretion came to be viewed as a bad thing to begin with and uniform sentencing the preferable alternative?
I think it grows from a long history where sentencing discretion was based around a model of rehabilitative sentencing, or what often gets described as a medical model for sentencing, where the judge should have lots and lots of authority to try to craft a sentence that's tailored to the individual characteristics of the offender so that that offender could have the best chance of being rehabilitated. But then as we moved into the 60s and 70s, after really three quarters of a century almost of that approach, the view became that rehabilitative efforts weren't working, that it was problematic to give judges unfettered discretion to sort of figure out who might or might not be rehabilitated. And in fact, there was some considerable research showing that there was a lot of disparity and even some discrimination in the way judges would make those judgments. And one of the ways that this got sort of derisively described is that you couldn't figure out what a judge would do. You'd have to know what they ate for breakfast. And if they weren't feeling well, you could expect a harsh sentence. And if they were happy, you expect a lighter sentence. And the thought was, if we could bring some new legal rules to help govern and guide sentencing, that would allow for greater consistency without having the risks of wide disparity and particularly a worry that some discriminatory factors might come into play when judges were exercising their discretion.
Although from the judge's point of view, I'm sure it would be, well, then why have us there at all? You know, you could do this by computer, phone it in.
Absolutely. The real challenge, and this is what the last 20 years of sentencing reform has been about, is trying to find the right balance between consistency and flexibility. That I think everybody understands that you can't and shouldn't sentence by computers, that you can't turn this into a mathematical formula, that you need to give judges some authority to be attentive to the particular circumstances of each individual case. The question is, how much authority? You've probably heard a number of the criticisms of how harsh and sort of offender-unfriendly the federal sentence system can be, and especially because judges see the real people in front of them. They've been particularly vocal in complaining about not having discretion in these systems.
And speaking of numbers, only about 4% of federal cases actually go to trial, which means that 96% of the sentences are coming from plea bargains. Is this going to mean that far fewer defendants will be willing to plead guilty? And if so, what's that going to do to the backlog in the court?
It's very clear that as a matter of pure number crunching, there's no way that the system can keep operating if a large percentage of charged defendants want to go to trial. And so, in some sense, the existing system is built around the assumption that there'll be lots and lots of plea agreements, and it works that way. And that's one of the things that the dissenters in Blakely were highlighting, that if you create a world in which you have to have juries trying a lot more issues, that there's a risk that you will bring the system grinding to a halt because administratively we just can't handle it.
What's anyone going to have to do to get this resolved?
Legislatures, I think, are sensible to go slow for the short term because I think, at least from what I'm hearing, it's only going to be a short matter of time before the Supreme Court speaks again. And hopefully they will do their best to at least clarify the ground rules. It's the analogy I like to suggest is it's as if there's an earthquake and then we have these series of aftershocks. And the problem is to rebuild the system, just like rebuilding a building, wouldn't be very wise while the ground is still moving.
Well, as you say, it certainly has been quite an earthquake. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
Douglas Berman is a professor of law at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. To read his Sentencing Law and Policy blog, you can visit our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the 9/11 Commission issues its final report. We'll listen in and find out from national security experts what the panel's recommendations could mean for the U.S. intelligence community.
We'll also hear from family members about the Commission's work and whether their concerns have been addressed.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In Saudi Arabia today, security officials found the head of Paul Johnson, the American engineer who was kidnapped and later beheaded. And in Iraq today, a militant group is threatening to behead six newly captured foreign workers. Despite these dangers, Americans are lining up to find work in Iraq because the benefits there exceed any they can find stateside. High salaries, health insurance, competitive retirement plans. In fact, Halliburton representatives say the company is receiving more than 100 applications a day. Chris Womack of Eufaula, Alabama, has been unemployed since January. He and his wife attended a job fair held by a Halliburton subsidiary last week. He joins us on the line from Eufaula. And Chris, I understand your wife didn't get a job offer, but you did. Are you going to take it?
Yeah, I actually leave on Monday.
How are you feeling about that?
Not really scared at all. I mean, I'm actually excited about the opportunity.
What was the appeal for you? Why were you even interested in working in Iraq?
I would have to say, first and foremost, is the opportunity to make, a very good salary.
Chris, how much are you going to make in a year?
Around $100,000.
How much did you make in your last job?
About 40.
How much did you make on unemployment?
I haven't drawn unemployment.
When did this light bulb go off for you, Chris? How did this happen that you thought, gee, maybe I'll try Iraq, you know, when you were unemployed?
I applied to stuff nationwide and wasn't getting a lot of callbacks. Taking all of that into consideration, you know, I always thought, well, I could always apply, you know, for something over in Iraq. I didn't think that many people would be interested in going over there, so I thought the odds may be good, you know.
We understand that at the job fair, they practically try to discourage people from taking the jobs. What did they tell you?
Well, it had a lot of downsides, to be perfectly honest with you.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff that really frightened most people was the fact they showed up typical day of 150-degree temperature and no bed. You know, you sleep on a cot, no air conditioner inside the living quarters. Also, the enemy fire and, you know, having the chance that you could actually be captured and killed. I mean, you have to take all of that in consideration. But I guess my faith in God helps me to believe that no matter where you are, you know, when it's your time to go, death will find you. So I'd rather be trying to make a way for my family than to be sitting here unemployed and losing everything I have.
But, you know, you've seen the pictures of the North Carolina-based contract workers who were killed by the mob in Fallujah and their bodies hung from over a bridge. And the videotapes of the threatened beheadings, and then, of course, two men were beheaded in Iraq. That didn't discourage you?
No, it didn't discourage me, and only because if you look at the United States, even here in a small town in Eufaula, Alabama, I mean, we have murders here every week. Halliburton has over 30,000 people over there, and to actually have had only two of those beheaded and, you know, a handful of people killed or what have you, to me, it's no more of a risk than being here in the States.
Well, Chris, you are off from Eufaula to Iraq. What are you going to do?
The job that I got was a labor foreman, so I'll be heading a team of employees in the actual rebuilding process.
A lot of incentives and a lot of money, but a lot of time away from home and a lot of danger. You think it's worth it?
Yeah, I really do think it's worth it. I mean, I look at the probability of if I don't go, you know, what could happen if I don't go. And I honestly would rather be dead than not take care of my family. I mean, that's the most important thing to me right now.
Well, Chris, good luck to you.
I appreciate it.
Chris Womack, he spoke to us from Eufaula, Alabama. A little article in the New Yorker magazine's Talk of the Town column this week alerted people to a practice surprising to some. The U.S. military offers free cosmetic surgery to its members and their families. Some of these military makeovers are done at Tripler Army Medical Center in Hawaii, where Army Major Dr. Jeff Healy is the chief of plastic surgery. We asked him how military personnel qualify for the procedures.
They have to first be seen by their primary care provider, and a consult is generated. And then, depending on time and space available in the operating room, we will contact some of those patients and bring them in for an initial evaluation to see if they are good candidates for the procedure or not.
Because we understand your primary work is reconstruction on military people who've suffered traumatic injuries in war, and that takes precedence over any cosmetic surgeries?
Absolutely. Yeah. The cosmetic procedures are just offered after all the reconstruction procedures are scheduled, certainly a secondary priority.
Well, a lot of people would be surprised that cosmetic surgery is offered free to service people at all. Why is it offered?
Well, part of the reason is so that the surgeons can maintain their skills. You know, when we go through our training programs, we train in the full spectrum of plastic surgery, which includes both reconstructive and cosmetic aspects. And in order to keep our skills current, we need to do all types of procedures. And so that's part of the reason to enable the surgeons to maintain their skill level.
Yeah. What kind of requests are you hearing?
We get requests for abdominoplasties, breast augmentation, liposuction, to name a few.
Doctor, it's been reported in the New Yorker magazine that some recruiters are using this as an enticement to get people to join the military by saying, you know, we'll give you free cosmetic surgery. Your thoughts on that?
I haven't heard that myself. I would caution anybody, buyer beware, when you're listening to a recruiter.
And you're in the military.
It's certainly not a guarantee that anybody's going to get cosmetic surgery if they join the military. That's not true.
What does it mean to a soldier, somebody on base, that they might be one of the people that gets a free cosmetic surgery procedure?
Well, I think for a lot of the patients, if they are getting the procedure done for the right reasons, it really helps with their self-esteem. It can make them feel better about themselves. For example, soldiers that request an abdominoplasty, for example, they are in good shape, obviously, to be active duty military, but still are unable to lose that extra skin and fatty tissue around the abdomen. So by getting an abdominoplasty, it really improves their self-esteem and helps them, I think, perform their jobs even better.
Hmm. What would you say to civilians who might say, hey, that's my taxpayer dollar there. You know, I thought it was going to armor, and instead it's going to a facelift.
You know, it's the medical care that is provided to the military members, and as I said, it's offered on a very limited basis. And the main component of that is to enable the surgeons to maintain their skill level in those procedures.
Yeah. Well, doctor, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Army Major Dr. Jeff Healy, Chief of Plastic Surgery at Tripler Army Medical Center.
Still to come, we speak to singer Rufus Wainwright about having famous folk singing parents and more.
You're listening to Here and Now.
What's in a name? Well, plenty, if the name is Carrie Edwards, not the politicians, Carrie and Edwards. We're talking about Carrie Edwards, the man. Mr. Edwards is a bail bondsman. He lives in Indianapolis, Indiana, and he has his own website, carrieedwards.com. And now, he's selling it. Hi, Mr. Edwards.
Hi, how you doing, Gail?
Very well, thanks. Tell us, when did you first get your website, carrieedwards.com, and what was the idea? What were you planning to do with it?
Registered back in 2002, and originally just registered the name because anything with .com behind it was getting bought up and registered. So I tried to see if my name was taken already, and it wasn't. So we went ahead and registered it. And didn't do much with it for the first couple months until I got a digital camera and found out how easy it is to put pictures up on the web, and that's what I was using it for.
And so now you're auctioning it off. Any bids yet?
Yeah, I believe our current bid is $150,000, and from there I'm not sure where it's going to move or if it's going to move, but it seems to be a pretty good value to any company. Generates great traffic.
So someone's already offered you $150,000, or that's what you're putting as the opening bid?
That's a current offer.
Really? And is it from the campaign?
No, I don't believe so. Not sure who the actual company is.
And at what point did you realize that your website could be a nice little nest egg for your retirement? I mean, was this the moment when John Kerry announced that John Edwards would be his running mate, and you went, oh, my goodness?
No, actually, back when it became apparent that Senator Kerry was going to get the nomination, a reporter from Seattle called me and asked me if I had registered the domain name in anticipation of a possible John Kerry, John Edwards ticket. And I told him, no, that's just my name and just registered for my own uses. And I think a couple weeks after that, somebody called me and made me an offer on it, and I figured if they're going to speculate, I'd hold on and see if it maybe would be worth something.
Describe the moment for me when you heard that John Kerry had picked John Edwards as his running mate, which meant Kerry and Edwards were two words that would go together in a different way than your name. What was your reaction?
It was actually kind of funny. My TV was on, and I was actually sleeping, and I actually woke up to the a phone call from the lead counsel for the John Kerry campaign, and I was trying to put everything together as I was waking up, and then I was thinking, oh, goodness gracious.
If you don't mind my asking, finally, have you decided who you're voting for in November?
Still undecided. I've been in an interesting position to, since having the website, I've gotten thousands of emails from people. Some people looking for the actual site, and some people just leaving me messages, political messages, and it's really interesting to hear what Americans have to say out there and what they're thinking, and it's made me think a little bit more about my vote, but I still have not decided.
Carrie Edwards, thank you so much.
Nice to talk to you.
Carrie Edwards spoke with us from Indianapolis, Indiana.
And if you'd like to bid on the Carrie Edwards website, go to ours, here-now.org.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@HERE-NOW.ORG. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
At 30, singer, songwriter, and gay advocate Rufus Wainwright has been taking stock of his life. He recently finished a month in rehab for alcohol and crystal methamphetamine abuse, something he says is a big problem in parts of the gay community. And some say a new maturity can be heard in his music. Wainwright, son of folk legends Loudon Wainwright III and Kate McGarrigal, is a troubadour for a different generation. This month he releases four songs on Apple's music downloading site iTunes, and they include The Gay Messiah, which has become an anthem for the same-sex community.
Better pray for your sins. Better pray for your sins. 'Cause the gay
Gay Messiah by Rufus Wainwright, who joins us in the studio. Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So, word has it you're gay. How do you feel about it? I mean, your mother was a...
But don't tell.
Your mother was a folk singer, and now every time I read about you, is you are a gay singer.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that being, you know, appended to your title?
You know, I don't really mind, only because... It certainly sets me apart from other male singer-songwriters. There's not a hell of a lot of us out there. So, I'm kind of proud of that. And also, in terms of being part of a tradition of great gay songwriters or people who work in that world, that's my legacy. I have that legacy to uphold.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm okay with it. I mean, it is sort of thrown around a lot and used and so forth. But I don't know, in this business, you gotta make an impression.
Well, there you go. And in fact, some have said that you've also written the anthem for gays, The Gay Messiah. Well, how'd that come about? What were you thinking?
Well, that started off as a joke. It came to me as a sort of funny song about having a gay messiah. And it was actually mainly a sort of answer to a more serious issue, which was the Israeli-Palestinian issue.
Really?
Yeah, because it basically, you know, there was all this talk about, you know, oh, the Jews want this and Islam wants this and Christian fundamentalists want that. And my basic argument was, like, essentially I can't even enter into the argument itself because we're not really represented in any of these major religions. I mean, there's no real gay doctrine or story that's, you know, feasible. So not that a lot of them are feasible, but that's, you know, understandable. So I sort of said, well, I'll add to the gospel and write a song about the gay messiah, just so we can talk about these issues
and anoint yourself Rufus
yeah,
the Baptist.
Yeah, so I did that. And then later on, when Passion of the Christ came out, coinciding with the Republicans or the Bush administration attempting to amend the Constitution and ban gay marriage in perpetuity, it became a very hot song because it, you know, in the title itself, it sort of mentions both of those issues.
What will happen in the steps? Someone will.
A lot of the songs that you're releasing through iTunes seem to have more of a political air than we've heard from you in the past.
I would never put on the air of being a protest singer or because there is a great tradition of that, which actually I think is kind of lost right now and should be revived. But yes, definitely I've tried to put a little more political spice in my dish.
And if I'm reading things correctly, you had to clear your head in order to do it.
I think, you know, after 9/11 and really after the election, quote unquote, I was very much becoming very vocal about, you know, my opinions. And I guess after years of being in show business and kind of all that entails with, you know, going out a lot and partying a lot, I went through this period where I would kind of argue about politics and world events, but really, I don't know, I felt like there was a much bigger issue that I was sort of ignoring, which was my own, you know, personal life. And that if, in order for me to really speak clearly about the world and to really have an opinion and be effective, I had to kind of put my own house in order first.
Some rehab.
Yeah, some rehab.
Yeah, you know.
So I did that.
Well, so that brings us to present time. As we said, you cleaned up your own personal act and started looking outward and wrote the song Waiting for a Dream.
Yeah.
What were you saying?
I based some of that song on a Wagnerian image of these women in the ring cycle called the Norns. And they're these sort of women who sit under the earth and they kind of knit. And they just kind of like knit time, and they're like sloths. They're kind of like half asleep. I kind of felt like one of those women at one point, and it was in that state between sleep and being awake. You know, and where, you know, you would sort of dream things and you would be like, wait a minute, my nightmares even are more sort of promising than the way real life is right now, just in the world, and how I really do feel like we're in this kind of semi-sleep mode at times in the world today.
Hmm.
My dad wrote a great song about it called I'd Rather Be Dreaming Than Living, or Sleeping Than Living, I don't know, sometime.
Your dad, Loudon Wainwright III.
Yeah.
For the present to pass, waiting for a dream to last.
What was it like growing up? I mean, got your dad singing that song and Dead Skunk and maybe Anna and Kate wandering through the house singing songs.
It was
something
amazing.
Else.
I was very singular.
Yeah, nobody else had that childhood.
Well, what was great about it is that there was no, I mean, whereas, you know, they were well known and appreciated, they weren't wildly famous or wealthy. So there was still very much a sense of working musicians and, you know, earning your bread and butter with song.
And you were exposed to the arts. And one song that I want to touch on is just so shimmeringly, achingly beautiful. It's called The Art Teacher.
Oh, you like that one. Thank
Loved
you.
That one. Was that a real experience for you?
That was a total fantasy.
Tell about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I feel bad about it sometimes. But I'd met this guy a while ago, who's very sweet and very nice, but very straight. And he was an art teacher, and he would teach at these girls' schools in New York, these very expensive girls' schools. And he would just tell me all these, you know, stories about how the girls would sort of flirt with him and how, you know, girls of a certain age, like 13, 14, are pretty intense sexually in a weird way. And it just sparked this idea for this song, and where I would sort of take on that role of the 14-year-old private school girl.
On a trip to the Metropolitan Museum.
Yeah, yeah.
In love with her art teacher and with the beautiful artists on the wall.
Yeah,
yeah. I looked at the Rubens and Rembrandts. I liked the John Singer Sargent's. He told me he liked Turner. Never have I turned since then. No, never have I turned to any other man.
How would you characterize where you are in your life right now?
Well, I mean, I would say that I'm kind of, you know, at a point where I have to happily and without, you know, morbid regret, you know, bid extreme youth farewell and accept the fact that, you know, I gotta be a man.
Rufus Wainwright, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Rufus Wainwright's newest songs are available on iTunes. His upcoming release, Want To, will be available later this year.
All this having been said,
a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, here and now.
On Earth. mesh pantsuit sort of thing. Thinking of the art teacher. I was just a girl there.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. On the web at mathworks.com.